Thank you very much. So as Rabbi Rutenberg said, it is fairly obvious to all of us that we are in exile. There's not much that that one can look around in the world and see that is not symbolic of exile. Granted, we are at the end of the exile. That's one thing which is for sure. We are towards the end of it. Jews have started coming back to Israel. The fact that we had that prisoner exchange, tragic as it was, folks, that's a manifestation of something amazing. For thousands of years, Jews were not living in Israel. Jews did not have their own country. Jews did not have their own army. Jews did not have their own government. Even with an idiot like Olmert, nevertheless, it is our government. He is our idiot. But there is nevertheless the fact that Jews have returned to the land of Israel. The fact, I mean, if you would have gone to someone 80 years ago, 90 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, not that long in terms of our history. You went to someone 200 years ago and said to him, yes, my name is Madam Zelda. I do predictions. Let me see your palm. What is it? It's a, I see that you will have great, great, great grandchildren who'll be living in a Jewish state in the land of Israel. They'd want their money back. They'd think you're crazy. I remember when I was was a rabbi in Toronto for 4 years. Just before, I was living in Israel before then, and I was in the army at the time. I was actually in reserve duty at the time. Now, the people from the shul's committee, the synagogue's committee, had come to negotiate a contract with me. So I got off from the base, and I went to the hotel where the people from the synagogue were there. It's always a great way to do contract negotiations if you've got a submachine gun with you. It's type of like, I find it very helpful. So anyway, so I went there, and I happened to have it with me. I didn't, thank God, have to use it, right? They acceded to all my demands. But it was about 8:30. The meeting is about 8:30 in the morning. I knocked at the wrong door. I got the room number wrong. So I go to this door, I knock on the door. So I stand there in uniform, had an M16, and I knock at the door. This guy, an elderly Jewish man, comes to the door, looks at me, and starts crying, and hugs me. I said, these negotiations are going to go well. Right? I said, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to ask for anything I want, man. This is unbelievable. And it turns out it was the wrong room, right? And he says, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry to disturb you. I'm actually supposed to meet someone, and I realize this is the wrong room now. I transposed the numbers, and I'm really, really sorry. He says, no. Thank you so much. I said, what's to thank? He said, you understand? He said, I'm a Holocaust survivor. He said, the last time I saw a soldier with a yarmulke was a chaplain. Jewish chaplain, I think it was from the Canadian Army, in the liberation of my concentration camp that I was in. And he says, I just didn't make it to Israel. It's been a long time, but I decided to make a trip to Israel. I'm an old man, I wanted to see Israel. And I got in late last night and came to the hotel. He says, I open the door, first thing I see in the morning is you standing there with a yarmulke, beard, tzitzis, an Israeli army uniform in Hebrew, says Tzahal. He said, it's overwhelming. It was unbelievable, right? And it is unbelievable. But despite all that, as we know, we have terrorist attacks. We have Hezbollah in the north. We have Hamas and the Fatah in the south. We have Syria. We have Iran. We have many, many enemies. We have 1.3 billion Muslims. Not all of them want to destroy us. I think there are two or three who, but I mean, whatever, but there's a fair amount of them who want to destroy the state of Israel, want to kill the Jews. There is a rise of anti-Semitism in the world. We know that. You have to look at France and England, Europe, certainly, but even in the United States and other places, there's been a rise in, and you know, anyone who has any familiarity with Jewish history knows that this exile has been long and difficult. And it's interesting, what is exile, where is exile first mentioned? You know, according to the Midrash, it's not explicit in the verse, but according to the Midrash, where is exile first mentioned in the Torah? You'd be surprised, maybe you don't, but you'd be surprised to know that where exile is first mentioned is actually the second verse of Genesis. Bereshit. Beginning of the Torah says, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim et haaretz. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Va'aretz, and the earth, or the land, that means the physical world, hayta tohu vavohu, was formless and a void. V'choshech al pnei tohom, darkness over the depths. That means matter, the physical, in shamayim and aretz, in biblical Hebrew, as Nachmanides points out, shamayim v'aretz doesn't mean the sky and the earth, right? Shamayim v'aretz means the spiritual existence and the physical existence. Shamayim, heaven, is a spiritual existence. Aretz is the physical, not the planet Earth. It also means the furthest reaches of the galaxy, right? It's all aretz. That's how the Nachmanides understands it. And so that says there that the aretz, meaning the physical existence, was tohu vavohu, was not formed. It was that there was space, time, matter, but it wasn't formed into anything. Vavohu, empty. Choshech, darkness. Al pnei tohom, over the depths. Meaning there was, it's like looking into the depths of something and you can't see the bottom, the depths. So in that second verse, the Midrash says, in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, he says the following. He says, Tohu, the earth, the world was desolate. This refers to the Babylonian exile, desolation. Vavohu, void. This refers to the Persian and Median exile, Paras Umadai, Persia and Medes. This refers to that exile. Babylonian exile was the destruction of the first temple. The siege of Jerusalem started, anniversary of that is this coming Sunday, 17th of Tammuz. Destruction of that temple, 9th of Av, 3 weeks later. Babylonian exile, 70 years in Babylon. During that time, the Jews assimilated rapidly, intermarried, forgot Hebrew, forgot much of the Torah. It was a terrible, terrible exile, even though it was only 70 years, but there was a lot of impact as a result of that, aside from the destruction of the temple, the loss of life, etc., etc. The second, when the Babylonian Empire was taken over by the Persians, and then the Medians, the Medes, Madaim, and of course during that time we had the threat of annihilation under Haman, right? And so there's a Purim story. And then he says, Choshech, darkness, that refers to the Greek exile. We came back to Israel, and 200 years after we came back to Israel, rebuilt the temple, rebuilt Jerusalem, rebuilt the land, the state, etc., etc., we again were invaded, but this time by the Greeks of Syria, under Antiochus Epiphanes, who invaded Israel, and they brought darkness, meaning they tried to, we talked about Torah enlightening, they tried to end darken, whatever, right? But they were, to put this in terminology, they were the people who brought darkness to the world, meaning that the light of Torah they tried to extinguish. And they tried to assimilate us like the Borg. They were the Borg of the ancient world. We will assimilate you. Resistance is futile. I see there are some literate people. Okay, good. Right, so Star Trek. Anyway, so, but what you have is, that's darkness. And then it says, over the depths where you cannot see the bottom, that refers to our present exile, started by the Romans, Edom, started by the Romans with the destruction of the second temple, also happened during the 3 weeks starting Sunday, Shiva, Sabbat, Tammuz, and Tisha B'Av, the destruction of the temple by the Romans, and the exile which has lasted since that time, we're still in that exile. At the end of it, but we're still there in that exile. So what's really weird, here is the beginning of all of creation, okay? And in the second sentence, we already have the idea of exile already mentioned, according to the Midrash, not explicit in the verse, but according to the Midrash, already in the second sentence, we have mentioned the various exiles of the Jewish people. Isn't that a strange thing? I mean, what is exile? People usually answer exile is punishment for sin. So if it's the second verse in the Torah, has anyone sinned yet? I mean, there's no one around to sin. What is that? You know, that's like you have a summer camp. Let's say you're running a summer camp. First day of the camp, you get up and you say, these are the punishments that we give to campers who go against the rules. And you start reading out the punishments. I mean, is that a great way to start the camp? Right? You know, it's like, it's not exactly a great way. You know, you're going to come to a camp like that, right? The first day, that's what they say. These are the punishments. In school, teacher comes, instead of the teacher, a good teacher does not start the year by saying, okay, kids, it is going to be a great year, because if you do one thing wrong, right, this is what's going to happen, 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 right? There are teachers like that, granted, I had a few of them, right? But nevertheless, you know, the teacher is good. He's going to start the day by saying, oh, we're going to have a great year, we're going to learn about this, we're going to learn about this, we're going to have fun, etc., etc. Right? Oh, by the way, if you mess up, there's punishment, right? But the first beginning of the Torah is a very strange idea. So what is that about? So in order to understand this, I want to go to an idea. This is actually based on the Arizal, Rabbi Isaac Luria, one of the great Kabbalists, probably the greatest Kabbalist of Tzfat, who used the Zohar, Jewish mystical tradition. Don't mess with the Zohar. It is very precious to us. And anyway, so what's so funny? Anyway, okay, right. So the Arizal points the following out. It says there are three major components of exile. What are the three major components of exile? So if you look in the Torah, we find a few things. First of all, we were in Egypt. We are described as strangers. Oh, by the way, I should point out another thing. The very first exile was the Egyptian exile. And the Egyptian exile, God said the Jews are going to go into exile. God told Abraham when he made the covenant between God and Abraham, what did God tell Abraham? At Brit Ben Avtar, he made a covenant with Abraham, a promise. I'll be your God. I'll give you the land of Israel, I'll guide you, I'll give you commandments, and so on and so forth. At the onset, as soon as God made that covenant, what else did God tell Abraham? He said to him, he said, and by the way, he didn't say by the way, but he said, oh, and your descendants will be slaves and strangers in the land that is not there for about 400 years. Same problem. Here he is, he's creating the covenantal relationship between God and Abraham and his descendants. And he says all the good, he says, yes, the land of Israel, he says this and he says that, but he also at the very outset says, and your children will go into exile. Your children will go into exile. Very strange thing to say at the beginning. And it appears to be, that also appears to be before the Jews have done anything wrong, right? There's only one Jew, Abraham, Sarah, right? Two Jews, okay? Right? Two Jews, they hadn't really done anything wrong at that point. What did they do wrong? They did something wrong. Commentaries struggle to understand what exactly is this. If exile is punishment, then what's a punishment for? Jews haven't done anything. God's already giving them a punishment. He's telling Abraham, you'll be punished, you'll be in exile. What's going on? Right? And it's a similar question to the idea of Genesis. Here you've got a Bereshit, Genesis. Before the world's created, before people are created, before our planet's created, there's already exile. And here, a Genesis of the Jewish people, i.e. the creation of the Jewish people, the covenant of God and Abraham, there already is a decree of exile already imposed upon the Jewish people. It's a very, very strange idea. We always thank God. I remember at the Seder this past year, so one of my kids asked me, we were talking about giving thanks to God for taking us out of Egypt. One of my kids said, Abba, he put us in there. So we're thanking him for taking us out. But hello, he put us there. Right? So doesn't one cancel out the other? Right? Someone comes over to me and goes, bam, bam, bam. Oh, here's a band-aid. There you go. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's great. Right? Very strange, right? So what's the idea here? So in order to understand this, we have to understand there's three components of exile. The Arizal points to three basic components of exile. Number one, the most basic is you're a stranger in a strange land. You are a foreigner. You don't belong. You're not in the land. You're not in your land. It's called a stranger in a strange land. Okay, so Jews have experienced that. You know, almost any country we've lived in, we were subject to expulsions. We were often not citizens. We were often chattel of the king. We were made to feel like strangers, being a stranger in a strange land. That's a simple, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. The idea that you're not familiar with the custom, you're not familiar with the language, you're not familiar with the social mores, etc. You know, I remember reading Michael Crichton's his autobiography, a famous author. So Michael Crichton went on a trip to Thailand, and he was invited to some people's house, and at the house, he walks in, there's a cute kid, and he pats the kid on the head. And the whole family, looks at him with horror. And he says, okay, anyway, they say, please sit down. He sits down, he's a big guy. He stretches out his feet. And his toes are pointing at the mother of this child. And everyone's like staring at him, and someone says, he's like moving his toes. Anyway, they say it's time to eat. So he gets up and he stretches. And everyone's just, oh, they're horrified. He stretches. What? What did he do? You pat a child on the head is a curse. So he cursed his host's child. Pointing your feet at someone is an insult. So he insults the hostess of the house, right? The mother. And then there's a statue of Buddha on a bookshelf. Nothing could be higher than the statue of Buddha, right? He's a tall American. He stretches. Guess what? He's now higher than Buddha. He's insulted their god. Yeah, so it's good that the guy, the owner of the house, was not into Thai boxing, right? Because he's just cursed his child, insulted his wife, and blasphemed his god. So that's an extreme example of not knowing what the heck is going on in the place, you know? You go to a pub in Australia, for example, if you don't turn your cup upside down after you finish drinking, because that is a challenge to anyone to come over and start a fight with you in the bar. Right? It's like you're saying, oh, that was great beer. You put it down because you want the guy to refill it. Put it upside down. So some like 8-foot guy, is a crocodile hunter, comes over to you and say, you want to fight with me, mate? Yeah. That's what it's going to be. So obviously, the first component of exile is being a stranger in a strange land, number one. As we say, Eret Giger Anochi Be'eretz Nochria, as Moses, when he called his son Gershom, which comes from the word a stranger there. He says, Kiger anochi be'eretz nochria, because I am a stranger in a strange land. That's where Heinlein got the title from. I'm a stranger in a strange land. That's number one. Number two, second component, is that we Jews were made to be slaves of the Egyptians. The second component of exile is that you are subject to someone else's whims. You are subject to someone else's desires. Right, what you want is nothing. It's irrelevant. It's not important. Right, it's only what the other person, what the master wants, that's important. Right, and for the Jewish people, indeed, we have been subject to what we call shibud malchuyot. Shibud malchuyot. That means subjugation under the kingdoms. In other words, as a nation, you don't have self-determination. Self-determination is a basic right of a people to determine their own destiny. Right, and if you are in exile, you don't have that ability. You don't have that ability. So you can live, even if you can live a wonderful life. In the United States, we are blessed, and as in all the democracies, we are blessed with the ability to live according to the Torah. We have freedom of religion, we have freedom of speech. It's a wonderful thing, right? But we are not ultimately the masters of our own destiny. We're not creating our own environment, our own society, our own state. We're living in a society, state, environment created by other people, right? And we have to conform to that, right? So it's a very mild form of shibud malchiot, of subjugation, but it's there. It's definitely there, and we've experienced much worse throughout history, as I'm sure you know. And the third aspect of exile is, as Haman expressed in the Megillah, when he said to King Ahasuerus, Haman said, Am mefuzar umefarad bein ha'amim. They are a nation that is mefuzar umefarad. What does that mean? Mefuzar means scattered. Umefarad means separate. Meaning, geographically, we're scattered all over the place, because Ahasuerus ruled 127 countries, and the Jews were scattered all over. And of course, today, Jews live, I mean, there's Jews almost everywhere in the world. There's almost, I don't know if there, I mean, I think, which there was one of the Gulf states just appointed a Jewish ambassador to the United States, believe it or not. Right? A woman who is Jewish, I think it was Qatar, just appointed a Jewish, which is pretty, well, I didn't know there were Jews in Qatar, right? But evidently there is at least one, right? And she's ambassador. But there's Jews literally everywhere, all over the world. We're scattered geographically. And Mefarad, what is Mefarad? What's the difference between Mefuzar or Mefarad, Hebrew, right? You go to that course, you'll know the answer to this. You don't go to the course, you won't know the answer. Next year you'll be here, I'll ask the same question, you'll say, oh, no, right? If you go to that course, you'll say, oh, simple, right? Mefuzar means geographically scattered. Mefarad means separated, meaning we're not unified. We don't feel a sense of unity, even when we may be together. We don't feel a sense of unity with other Jews. We're not families, right? Have fights, feuds. The Hatfields and the McCoys, right? The Campbells and the McGregors, to name just two Jewish feuds, right? But we have the situation where we're not united. We are scattered geographically, and we are separate. in the sense of we're not really united. Okay, we're not close to each other, and everyone has divisions and etc. So those are the three components of exile. Right? Being a stranger in a strange land, foreign environment, number one, place. Being subjugated, your time is not your own, subjugated by someone else. Someone else is your master, you are the slave. You don't own your own time, that's time. And you are scattered and separate, that's personality. We don't have the, we're not united with the persons we want to be united with, we're scattered and separate around the world. What we might call space, time, and person, space, time, and self, right? Alluded to, there's an idea that okay, we'll get to that, but this world we talk about as being, the Sefer Yetzirah, Book of Creation, talks about this world as being composed of Olam Shana Nefesh. Olam Shana Nefesh. Olam means world or space. Shana means year or time. Nefesh means self, soul. So space, time, self. And in these areas, that's what exile is. And of course, as the Maharal points out in his book Netzach Yisrael, which is a book about exile, the Maharal of Prague points out that each of these three components is unnatural. It is unnatural that a nation should not live in its own land. It is natural that the nation should live in its own land. That's natural. He says the fact that we're not in our own land is unnatural. He says it is natural that you should have the right of self-determination. It is natural that your time should be yours to choose to do with what you want. It is natural that you should not be under the subjugation of someone else. So therefore, that aspect of exile is also unnatural. And he says it is also the idea that people should live together. Communities, families should be united. Nations should be united, should live together, right? And it is also unnatural that we're not. So now, given that those are the three components of exile, the Arizal says, Rabbi Isaac Luria says, he says, we now have to look at it in the following way. Every person on the face of this planet, in a sense, is in exile. Why is that? Why is everyone in exile? Some wealthy guy, you know, who's fabulously wealthy, has a, $300 million mansion on the, on the shores of the, right in Seattle, and he's got a private plane, a few private planes, he's got a whole selection of cars. He's in exile. Why is he in exile? Everyone is in exile, but that guy doesn't care. He's not Jewish, let's say. So why does that make him an exile? Right? I mean, you're right to a certain degree, but why is he in exile? The answer, where are these three components? The answer is every single human is in exile because, in essence, the essence of the human being is body and soul. Human being is body and soul, but the unique combination of body and soul, that's what makes a human human. And that aspect of the human being, which is the spiritual aspect of the human being, the non-material side, the side that doesn't respond to reductionism, is not materialist, it's the spiritual side of the human being, that aspect of the human being, that's in exile in all three ways. Think about it. The soul, which is spiritual, is living in a world which is basically a world of time and space and matter. That's an unfamiliar foreign world for the soul. Soul is spiritual. The spiritual doesn't have the divisions of time and space. It doesn't have, it's limited. The soul feels very limited. One of the reasons, a very interesting comment which a friend of mine once made after he had just gone down a hill in Davos, Switzerland, in a toboggan, very, very fast, and thought he was going to die a number of times. And he asked one of his teachers, why is it that people like to go fast? Why do people like, go fast things, fast cars, roller coasters? I personally hate them, but people like this type of stuff. Right, so he said it's the desire of the soul to escape the confines of the physical world. It's an expression that the soul feels limited. It wants to break out. Right, sometimes when you're on the plane for hours and hours, and you're sitting there, and you're sitting between the two, sumo team, right, has got a block of seats, right, and they all order special meals, vegetarian, right, and you ordered a special meal, kosher, so they put you in the middle of the sumo team, in economy. So you think it's bad enough with it. So you're sitting there, and it's a flight to Australia, Los Angeles to Australia. 15 hours, right? 15 hours on the plane, right? I mean, when you're in that flight, I mean, what do you want to do? When you get off the plane, you are desperate to get off. You know, 15 hours, when they open the door to that plane, you're up, you're a nanosecond, right? And now it's like you're standing up, right? You're waiting to get out, right? It was like, you know, and you get out there, you just want to run and stretch. It's like, you're confined, right? We can't move one space. So it's like my kids feel at the end of the school year. You know what I mean? The school finishes, they're like, ah. I said to my kid, what do you want to do today? Oh, just nothing. I'm just like, so, nothing. I don't do anything, right? I'm just so happy just to be like, ah, like, right? I mean, and it's now, what is it, 2 weeks into summer vacation? I ask, everything okay? He says, oh, it's great. It's like, great. Yeah. I don't know. Bechas don't like school. Right? So, but you feel confined. The soul feels like that. Everyone, therefore, is an exile because every soul, you're a stranger in a strange land. The soul feels a little uncomfortable in this world. A little uncomfortable. Secondly, we said there is the shibud malchiyot, i.e. you are enslaved. You are subjugated to someone else's whims. The soul is not totally free either. Why? Because the soul is subject to the needs of the body. Right? The soul wants to listen to the class. The body wants to sleep. Right? The soul wants to pray. The body wants to eat. Now, the body's not evil. It's okay to eat and sleep. Not during my class. That's a sin. Right? But at other times, other people's classes, it's fine. Right? But except the Hebrews, whatever. But again, and the soul is subject to that. The soul has no choice in that. Right? You can't go without eating. You can't go without drinking. You cannot go without sleeping. Right? You've got to. There are certain things you have to do. Okay. So the soul. I had a roommate in yeshiva who used to be really annoyed by the fact that he had to eat meals. It was like such an interruption in his day. Right, he was annoyed. Right, I was like, oh, I'm starving. I can hardly wait for lunch. And he's saying, oh, lunch. I have to eat because I can't go on without eating. It was like such an annoyance. You know, it was just it was like an annoyance. So he had to close his Gemara, his Talmud, and he had to go and eat. Which explains why he is a huge scholar and a Rosh Kollel now. Right. But nevertheless, it was an annoyance. So the soul is subject. In other words, the soul is in exile also for the second reason. And the third reason, mefuzar umefarad, meaning scattered and separate, that third reason is also there. Because in the world, in the spiritual world, the soul has a sense of unity with other souls. The aspects of life that give us things like jealousy and hatred that exacerbate that don't exist in the spiritual world. Right? There's no competition for attention. There's no competition for love. There's no competition for money. There's no competition for food. Right? There's no competition for a parking space or to get into the Lincoln. Right? Or whatever. There's no competition. Right? In other words, there's a sense of unity. So the souls are not scattered and separate. So when you think about it, every single one of us is actually in exile, because the soul's in exile. Which means, why does the Torah start with exile? Because creation of this world, in a sense, was the creation of a place of galut. It's a place of exile. So that means being in this world is not a punishment for the soul to be in this world. Evidently, there must be something positive about it. Even though what I've mentioned are negative things, apparently, right? We are strangers in a strange land. We are subjugated to someone else's whims, and we are scattered and separate. But nevertheless, right, if God's put us here, right, there's obviously some positive purpose in that. Right? That means the same is true in Egypt. Right? You look through the Torah, and I think we may have discussed this before Pesach, I do not remember. But if you look through the Torah makes tens and tens, I mean over 35 references to the fact that we were slaves in Egypt. Where does the Torah say it? The Torah says, don't oppress the stranger because you were strangers in Egypt. Be accepting of the convert because you were strangers in Egypt. Don't cheat in your weights and measures because God took you out of Egypt. Like, there's all these references to justice and social justice and honesty and truth and all these and sensitivity, etc., etc. And the Torah always refers back to Egypt. In other words, what happened in Egypt was we learnt how to be sensitive. We learnt how to understand the stranger. We learnt how to understand suffering. We learnt how to pursue justice. We learnt how to be united. We learnt a lot of things in Egypt. So the fact that we were in Egypt was spring training, so to speak, for us to become a nation, to become the people of Israel. That was the time that we were training to be people of Israel. Right? We grew as a result of that exile. And in fact, That exile was a result of that exile. We were born, we were created as the Jewish people. Jewish people was born at the Exodus from Egypt. That's when we became the Jewish people. And we are molded by the Exodus. So that means what is supposed to happen in this world? In this world, the soul is supposed to grow as a result of those things. What is it supposed to do? Well, if you're a stranger in a strange land, what do we try to do? And this is what people do. We try to recreate an environment. We try to make the land that we're in similar to the environment that we came from, right? So we build a store. We have a store that sells the food that we're used to eating in the old country. We build a synagogue that looks like the one in the old country. We build houses that look like the one in the old country. We try to live in community. Isn't that what we try? It's a normal thing. Everyone does that, right? It's a totally normal thing. So what is the soul supposed to do? It's supposed to turn this world into a more spiritual world. It's supposed to find, it's supposed to convert this world. As the verse says, Hashamayim shamayim lahashem v'haaretz natan livnei adam. Which means the heaven is the heaven unto God, and the world was given to humanity. Now, the Kotzker Rebbe translated that in the following way. The heaven is already heaven for God. The world was given to us to make into heaven. All right, so we're supposed to change this world and make it a more spiritual place. So the soul will be more comfortable. The soul is probably not comfortable in a mall. Walks along the mall. Everything in the mall is basically, right, just most 90% of the stuff there, things that I don't need. Right? Buy things that I don't need. Okay? And then the other 10% are things that I need but I could get much cheaper somewhere else. And the whole experience is like, it's just like this massive, overwhelming materialism. Right? The soul's not very comfortable there. The soul's probably comfortable when it comes to Beit Gavriel. I'm saying the soul feels uncomfortable, right? The soul feels comfortable when it comes to a Seder, Passover Seder, Pesach Seder. Soul feels, right? So, but we want to make this world into a world that's comfortable for the soul. So that's what the soul's about to do. In other words, to make this world into heaven, so to speak. Secondly, right, we are subjugated to this foreign master, i.e. the body. So what's the answer there? To have the master turned into a partner. So this master is no longer opposition, but it actually works together with me, right? So the body and the soul should work together to create a harmony between the body and the soul. And the third area, which is I feel separation with other people, is to create a unity between myself, ourselves, and other people, to create a unity. So you think about it, the Arizal will put it this way, that the commandments of the Torah can all be categorized under one of these three categories. There's a mitzvot which are designed to make the space of this world a space which is permeated with the spiritual. When I walk into a house and there's a mezuzah on the door and there's Jewish books in the house and there's Shabbat candlesticks there and there's there's pictures of the land of Israel and so on and so forth. So I walk in there. I walk into a dorm room, right? I walk into a house and there is a 72-inch plasma, high-definition television, Blu-ray, right? 8 speakers, right? Set into the walls, right? The whole works, right? And that's the centerpiece of the house, right? And there's posters up of movies, right? And there's and the books are basically all garbage, right? So I don't feel that I've transformed this world. It's made the soul more uncomfortable, not less comfortable, more uncomfortable. So to transform this world into a world which is comfortable for the soul, number one, that's some mitzvot are doing that. There are the mitzvot that sanctify space. Those are the mitzvot that transform something into a different space. Transform into a different space. They have that. A friend of mine has a shul. He's a rabbi of a synagogue in San Diego, La Jolla, San Diego. And his synagogue is beautifully designed. It's gorgeous. And it won this award. They have an award in California for the best sacred space in the state. The best sacred space in the state. So, but it's actually, for once, Californians are correct, right? There's a sacred space. Now, there's a certain space can be sacred. You can transform space into something holy. And in addition, we said the mitzvot to make your body a willing partner of the soul, right? The way to make someone a partner, this is true in all relationships, is not by command and not by oppression and not by force, but by making the other person feel and believing it, that they are a partner, an equal partner with you in the building of something. So the body and the soul are partners. For example, we believe that the kosher diet is a diet of spiritual sensitivity diet, meaning it's supposed to help my body become a little more spiritually sensitive. Okay, the various laws of the Torah are there to train and elevate the body so that the body and the soul can work together. And the third area, as we said, mefuzar mefurad, scattered and separate, there are commandments of the Torah whose purpose is to unite and bring people together. Mitzvot we call bein adam lechaveiro, between one person and another. So in a sense, what we have here is really the exile and the solution of exile. Every one of us is an exile. Now, inasmuch as everyone on the planet is, in a sense, is an exile in each of these three ways, and everyone is supposed to try to redeem themselves, right, get out of their Egypt, right, get out of their Egypt and make the world and get out of the exile into the redemption. So the idea of the exiles that we have gone through is because we didn't understand this lesson. And here is a crucial point to understand. Let's say if we all really understood that my soul is in exile and that my purpose here is to transform my environment into an environment where the soul is comfortable, to transform my physical into a physical being that is working in harmony with the soul, and to unite with other souls, if we really understood that, in other words, if we understood that we were in exile, we wouldn't need any exiles other than that. The fact that we're in this world would be sufficient exile. Does it make sense? Do you understand? Right. In other words, but let's say a person doesn't feel that the soul's in exile. Let's say the person is totally comfortable in this world. Totally comfortable. Completely comfortable in this world. What exile? What are you talking about? Right? Soul? There are certain people you talk to. If I would say to certain people this idea that your soul is an exile, they'd think I'm crazy. They'd go crazy. They'd say, what are you, kidding? Look at this Hummer. It's the most comfortable car. I mean, I'd say, right? Or forget a Hummer. A Bentley is very comfortable, right? They killed 30 young calves for the seats in my Bentley, right? I'm so comfortable, there's air conditioning coming at me from every direction, including the seat, right? I am floating, I'm not even sitting, I'm floating. I put the air conditioning up high, I hover above the seat. It's unbelievable, right? The car almost steers itself. I say, what's to be uncomfortable? What are you, crazy? So, granted, he's got a good point. No, I'm saying that you see, such a person is so embedded in the material, they don't even understand that the soul has needs and it has a certain level of discomfort there. They've so to speak, right, they are happy to be in exile. And there are people like that. There are people like that. There were Jews in Egypt who wanted to stay in Egypt. They said, this is great. What more could you want? They give us free food. We get free accommodation. True, we have to work hard. Right, they kill us occasionally, but otherwise it's fine. But there actually were people who wanted to stay there. And the Midrash tells us that Jews stayed behind in Egypt. Some say they died. There is a metaphorical explanation that maybe they didn't die, maybe they just became Egyptians. And maybe the people we fought five in the state of Israel, right? Some of those people, right, may be descended from Jews who stayed behind in Egypt. The 4/5, who knows? Right, and there were Jews who were very comfortable in the Greek exile, right? And guess what? Many of them assimilated, and they're probably Greeks today, right? These are the guys who are writing on the polls in the European Union when they made the poll about which are the most dangerous nations in the world to world peace, right? And they listed United States, Israel, North Korea, Iran, etc. So Greece had America at the top, and then Israel was second. So the most dangerous nation to world peace is the United States, clearly, right? And the second most dangerous nation to world peace is obviously Israel, right? So some of the idiots, right, some of these morons, right, too much ouzo and calamari, right, in Greece, right, some of them, to our embarrassment, may be descended from Jews who assimilated at the time of the Maccabeans. Very likely. Very possible. So a lot of people are comfortable in that exile. So now, what do I do with someone? What do you do with someone who doesn't realize that the soul is an exile? How can I make such a person realize that there is an exile? So what does God do? If the person doesn't realize that he's a stranger in a strange land, in terms of the fact that he's got a soul, and the soul is spiritual, what does God do? He takes this whole person, and what does he do? He puts him in a strange land. So he says, now you know what it's like. So he's in a strange land. He's a stranger in a strange land. Maybe, has he got the hint? Some people get the hint at that point. Some people would get the hint at that point. What about a guy who doesn't get the hint? Right? What do you have to do? You have to increase the... You have to increase... You can't do a hint anymore, right? Certain people, you can just say... you know, there are certain people... Someone's doing something annoying sometimes. Certain people, I can just say... just go like that. Right? And they'll understand. Instantly. They'll understand. Some people, you say... Sorry? Right? And then they'll understand. With some people, you have to go over to them and go, hello! Right? And then they'll say, what? Was something wrong? Right? And that's... You know, that... So in the immortal words of Monty Python, a nudge is as good as a wink to a blind bat, right? So here, a blind bat, a nudge and a wink are totally the same thing, right? However, to someone who's more than a blind bat, so you have to, you know, a little more subtle. But let's say the person didn't pick it up. So what does God do? He puts that person in a strange land. He says, so, and then hopefully the person will say to says, oh, this is what it means. Ah, okay. This is what it means. And then what if he doesn't get it? Then God has a king, like a pharaoh, who comes along and now he subjugates them. And now you're enslaved. He says, you didn't think you were a slave. Now, this is what slavery is. This is what it's like. And if he doesn't get the hint, then he scatters them. In other words, the exile is here for us to realize that we're in exile. The purpose of exile is to realize that we're in exile. Meaning, the purpose of the national exile is to realize that as individuals, each of us is, in fact, in exile. And just as in the national exile, what we try to do is to make, to survive and to thrive in the exile, and to alleviate it and to prevent it and to stop it and so on and so forth. So in the individual exile of the soul, we're supposed to do the same thing. So in the same way as we try in our physical exile, a stranger in a strange land, I try and build a neighborhood and be comfortable in this neighborhood, right? And we have the shul, and we have this, and we have that, etc., etc. So guess what? We're supposed to see that and take it to the individual level. I'm supposed to make my home, my environment, etc., an environment and a home and a space, which is a sacred space, where the soul is comfortable. Secondly, right, I am supposed to also, just as I have to maybe fight against this oppression, right? I may have to try to prevent self-defense, whatever it happens to be. But also in the spiritual sense, we have to do the same thing, to try to not fight against the body and the soul, not to have this fight, but to have the harmony there. And also in terms of the creation of unity between one person and another, which of course is also central to what we're supposed to do in this exile. So when we think of it, that is why exile is mentioned at the beginning of the Torah. That's why the Jews went down to Egypt. And that's why we're still here. What I mean by still here, we're still in exile. Because obviously we didn't pick up the hint. Right? We didn't get the hint. There are plenty of people who just never got the hint. Right? And if all of us would actually get the hint, then we'd, in other words, if we would redeem ourselves individually from our own Egypt, whatever that Egypt is, right, then nationally we'd be redeemed. And then if nationally we'd be redeemed, the whole world would be redeemed. Because we'd be able to show the rest of the world the idea that we're trying to say, right? But that is the essence, I believe, of what exile is about. So Elokai neshama shenatata bi tohara, we say every morning, my God, the soul that you've placed within me is pure. You created it, you formed it, etc., etc. That soul which is pure, right, is in a world which is not totally, which is not pure, right? And we don't seek to escape from this world. That's not the job, right? Is to transform this world, That's what we're really meant to be doing, right? And we just haven't understood that. So when the Jews have been in exile, certain times and places, we have, like, you know, understood that. We've transformed our own little four cubits. We've worked on it. We've worked on it, but not enough. And we don't realize it enough. And it's interesting, in Hebrew, the word for exile, the Maharal points out, is gola. Gimel, vav, lamed, hey. Gola. Exile. Right. Exile is gola. He says, what is the word for redemption? Ge'ula. What is the difference between Gola and Ge'ula? Just an Aleph. Right? It's very interesting. If you put Aleph into Gola, you get Ge'ula. Gola, Gimel, Vav, Lamed, Hay, exile. Ge'ula, Gimel, Aleph, Vav, Lamed, Hay, is redemption. Aleph. What is the Aleph? The Aleph is exactly this idea. What do I mean by, why is Aleph this idea? Because Aleph is what letter does the Torah start with? No, it starts with Bet. The letter starts with Bet. Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning God created Bet. The Torah doesn't start with Aleph. Why? Because Aleph is the world, is the unity of God, the perfect unity before there was a creation. As soon as there was a creation, the reason the Torah starts with Beit for creation, because Beit is two. And what that means is, creation is already the beginning. As soon as there was a creation, there's already the beginning of Pirud, separation. There is already the beginnings of the beginnings of separation of us from the unity of God, separation of one unity, right? Separation of the soul from that world. This is the world of Beit. Right, and it's supposed to get back to the world of Aleph, right? To create that unity, and we get that back to that world of Aleph. We put the Aleph into the Gola. That's when we get Geula, and that is why Rabbi Akiva. And so, really, Geula is not far away from Gola, meaning the redemption is not distant from the exile. There are many opportunities of redemption in the exile which we haven't necessarily picked on. We haven't necessarily. We have very often let them pass us by. There have been opportunities, for example, let me give you an example. 1967, Six-Day War. Following that war, there was a tremendous feeling of unity in Israel. There's a tremendous feeling of unity of Jews all over the world. There were Jews who never cared about Israel, who would put on their radios 24 hours a day to listen to what was happening in the Six-Day War. It was unbelievable. The Jews of the Soviet Union, that was the Six-Day War, was like this wake-up call for so many of them, right, to like start thinking about, well, I'm Jewish, Israel, that's it. Right, Jews in America, totally similar. And soon after that, lots of young Jewish students started, that was the beginnings of people coming to Israel to volunteer, to do this, to go to Israel. It was unbelievable opportunity. And God smiled at us. He showed us miracles. He showed us this tremendous military victory. It's just like stunning, right? Israel was now this, was expanded. It was unbelievable. He smiled at us. But as one of the great rabbis said, but we didn't smile back. We didn't smile back. He smiled at us. We didn't smile back. So some people, the euphoria went over, and then a few weeks later, they went back to hating the guy from the other party. And then some people looked at it and said, oh yeah, I thought it was a miracle at the time, but I realize now the Syrians just had lousy tactics. You know, or some will say, yeah, and then some people said, you know, maybe Israel was the aggressor. You know, and then it started, we lost it. We lost it. I remember after the Gulf War, I think that was an opportunity as well. Right? During the Gulf War, I was living in Israel at the time. During the Gulf War, there was a tremendous feeling of unity in Israel. There was a feeling of camaraderie. It was unbelievable. It was really weird. You know, we went to the local school to pick up our gas masks. Right? I don't know if you imagine. Let's imagine that you know the mayor, right, Mayor Bloomberg. There's an announcement that everyone living in New York should go to the local closest public school. You'll get a notice in the mail to pick up gas masks because of an imminent chemical attack on New York. What do you think the schools would look like on the day that you're supposed to go there to get the gas mask? Yeah. What type of atmosphere would there be? Huh? Panic, crazy, riots. I mean, there'll be like psychologists all around for support groups, right? Americans always need support groups, you know. Right? If they'd go through what Israel's gone through, that all there'd be would support groups. That'd be the industry of the country. Right. It was unbelievable, right? So it would be crazy. I remember we went to the local school. People are standing there. There's someone there selling ices, and there's someone selling falafel, right? All the Americans have got video cameras. Hi, Mom, we're picking up our gas mask. It was like, wait, so the kids' ones, like the kids with the plastic bags over your head. Oh, that's great. Not for the grandmother, no. Right, just so, right? It was unbelievable, right? I remember going to a wedding during the Gulf War. Everyone at the wedding had a gas mask with them. And we're dancing around the gas, right? The chosen. The chatan, I was teaching the chatan, right? So he was in the in our sealed room with us the 2 nights before the wedding. I remember the kids would go to school, they come home with decorated boxes for the gas masks. Kids, look at my gas mask. Oh, that's so cute. What do you draw on that? Right, whatever. Oh, this is an ICBM missile system. But there was a feeling of unity in the country, right? And there was a feeling of everyone being in it together, and it was an opportunity lost. It was an opportunity lost. We've had so that's why that's another reason. The Maharal says that Geula and Gola are so close because we do have opportunities like that, and we have them in our own lives as well. You have an opportunity in your own life. You feel like a moment of inspiration. We feel like a moment of, the soul is really, this is what I want for the rest of my life. But then what happens is, oh yeah, but I've got a meeting 2 minutes, right? And then we forget it. So that's the idea. That's what Gullet is about. It's about opportunity here and opportunity here and opportunity here. It's about, and in our own lives. So really, the exile as a whole is really what we look at as a metaphor. It's a metaphor, a mashal, for the exile within. And when we cure the exile within, we'll be able to cure the exile outside, right? But it's got to start. We don't believe in starting with I'm going to change this whole neighborhood or the whole world. The way we start is changing ourselves. The great rabbi, I think it was Reb Chaim Ozer Grzinski, who from Vilna, he was in Vilna. He once said that he thought when he was young that he would change Europe. He would change the face of the Jews of Europe. That's what he wanted to do. He realized that it was too difficult. So he decided, I'll just try to change Lithuania. He said, then he realized, he got a little older, he realized that's not going to happen. He says, okay, I'll work on Vilna. My city, Vilnius, Vilna, I'll work on Vilna. He realized at that point, that's rough. It's not going to happen. He got a little older. He realized, okay, what about just my family? So my family, right, the hardest thing. He says, then he got a little older. He realized, you know what? I'll change me. Chaim Ozer, that's what I'll work on. He says, I can do. But what's interesting is Chaim Ozer Grzinski was such an amazing person. By changing himself, he did change his family. And he changed, and he affected Vilna, and actually he affected all the Jews of Europe. Many, many of the Jews of Europe were affected by him in amazing ways. So that's how it starts. It's not the don't look at Europe, Vilna, Lithuania, etc., right? Yeah, it's got to look at each person themselves, and they're getting out of their own Egypt, getting out of their own exile. And when we do that, then we'll get out of the exile and bring some light from the darkness. That's it for this evening. Thank you very much. Be happy to take questions. Yeah.
Any signs before the redemption?
Many signs before the redemption. The Talmud at the end of Tractate Sota discusses quite a few of them. Although I should point out, to be honest here, what Maimonides says is no one really knows. Ultimately, no one really knows for sure, right? There are hints and there are contradictory predictions in the works of the sages. Because the way the redemption will happen is to a great degree dependent upon what we do. So therefore, it's not going to be clear. Even in the eyes of the prophets, but the details would not be clear. But there are some signs. I would say the return of Jews to the land of Israel is a major one. Right? Rashi, the Talmud mentions, actually it's a verse, which says, Va'atem ha'ar Yisrael, ampechem titnu piryam, when the mountains of Israel and the valleys of Israel start flowering and giving forth their fruits and agricultural products for the Jewish people, that's a sign the redemption is coming. So we have some signs, pretty clear ones, but we don't know for sure what stage, but we know it's very soon. Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you very much, and well over the fast, we say in Australia, well over the fast, and hopefully see you in the future.